ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
Ever since the COVID-19 pandemic began, we've all been washing our hands like never before. Some of us have even been taking the extra step of using antibacterial soap to try to make sure we're doing everything possible to keep clean. But are those antibacterials a good idea? Perhaps not. On this edition of UWM Today, we're talking to a UWM public health expert whose research into antibacterial products raises some questions of whether using them is actually putting us at risk. Hongbo Ma is an associate professor of environmental health sciences at the Zilber School of Public Health. Welcome to today's program, Hongbo.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Great to have you on the show today. Well, let's give our listeners a little bit of history first. When were antibacterials first developed?
So the development of antimicrobial could be actually be dated back very early in 1910s around. But the first commercially used is about 1930s. And then the very massive use of antimicrobials used in personal health products starts in 1950s, because we need to have those products to keep our body, our hands to clean, to fight for disease, as our knowledge about how those pathogens or bacteria on our hands, on our body can cause disease. So from probably began like 1950s or 60s for the very massive use in personal care products.
And so the intention was great, but I understand that 3 years ago, the Food and Drug Administration actually banned the use of some of the antibacterial agents because of safety issues. What were those?
So when we introduce antimicrobial products, especially for everyday use for the general public, we need to consider like two factors. The first is their effectiveness, and then the second is their safety. So we want them to be effective to prevent or to get rid of those pathogens. We also want them to be safe so they do not cause harm to human body. And the reason the FDA was banning those, I believe it's 19 ingredients, is because they were not doing a better job than the regular soap and water. We know we have been doing this so many years, just washing our hands with soap and water. And they can get rid of the wash away those pathogens. So the antimicrobials, they do the same thing. They don't do a better job than the regular soap. But on the other hand, if we think about safety, they could actually have potential long-term adverse effects. First is they could promote antibiotic resistance. Means when we use them too much, they kind of make the bacteria more resistant. So next time, the same antibiotic would not be effective. So they promote antibiotic resistance. And another thing important for some of those compounds is that we found they were potentially endocrine disruptors, which means those chemicals, we use them every day, and we may get some of those into our body. And in the long term, they kind of interrupt our endocrine system within human body. Within the past few decades of research, we have shown there were many, many of those ingredients from personal care products, they were endocrine disruptors. So basically, because they were not being more effective than the regular soap and water, and second, they have potential long-term health effects, promote antibiotic resistance, and to be an endocrine disruptor. That's basically the two main reasons why FDA are banning those ingredients.
But antibacterials are still around because, as I understand it, back in 2017, when they did say a whole list of antibacterials should be taken off the market, they at the same time approved another set of antibacterial agents that they said would be okay to be put into soaps and personal hygiene products. How are these new ones different from the ones that had been banned?
I think that's a great question, Tom. So when we talk about why we still need those antimicrobials, it really we have to think about a different scenario. So for example, if just you and I, we are general public, we're probably not exposed to those terrible pathogens like a physician or a nurse working in a healthcare settings. So the general soap and water would be sufficient to protect us. But for some of the physicians or the doctors or the nurses, and they were exposed to probably a more dangerous environment, and or for they were handling patients, they were very immunocompromised, and they need extra help. So those antimicrobials, they were important, they're helpful. But then you have to kind of to weigh out the benefits and the risks. So it's always a choice. And even though FDA banned those ingredients for the over-the-counter hand soaps for general use, but they were still allowed in a healthcare site, in the clinics and hospital. So back to your question, why they are still approved, some of them, I think they were looking at their effectiveness and looking at their safety and also to see the necessity if they really need those. So it's a kind of a continual process. You kind of have to weigh out the benefit and risks.
So it's not inconceivable that as more research is done, that the FDA may step in perhaps again and say they're being overused or that they are providing a greater risk to our health than an aid.
Yeah, that is possible. So unfortunately, the current regulation framework is really kind of a little bit left behind. And like before we kind of find a very solid evidence, it is harmful. It has a potential risk in the long term. And they were allowed to be on the market. It's just like the story of those a few ingredients, including triclosan, triclocarban. Just like those, they have been used for decades until recently we found abundant scientific research evidence showing their endocrine disrupting effects and showing their promotion to antibiotic resistance, and then FDA binding them. So there's always a little bit kind of left behind. It's kind of outpaced by the development of those new compounds.
You talked a moment ago about how these can be disrupting our endocrine system. Could you tell us what that means? What happens when you have an endocrine disruptor in these antibacterials?
Yeah. So the endocrine system is very important in control our development, our reproduction. And our body have natural hormones to control. It's a very sophisticated, it's a very delicately controlled system. There are some man-made chemicals, once they get into our body, they could mimic those natural hormones. So basically, they could turn on those response, which they were not supposed to, or they could shut down the response when the process should begin. So basically, they kind of mess up our development pace or the developmental stage. For example, in the past 3 decades, the breast cancer has been the risk, the incidence have kind of increased by over 50%. And they're actually, it's very closely associated with our exposure, long-term exposure to those man-made chemicals. And they kind of changed our reproductive system, our development system, and contributed to that disease. And also, like for the girls, puberty has kind of become earlier, one or about on average 1 to 2 years earlier than maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Those are all the long-term effects of those man-made chemicals caused to our body, not just to humans, to the fish, to our ecosystem. They cause the imbalance of the species, the population in the ecosystem. So that's a huge challenge, actually, for human health and the ecosystem health by those endocrine disrupting chemicals.
So as you think, Hongbo, about the situation that we're in today, dealing with the COVID-19 crisis, I can imagine some listeners are saying, well, there's a possibility that the antibacterials might conceivably harm me somewhere down the road, but we have this immediate crisis. We have a pandemic. Shouldn't I do everything possible to kill those germs and make sure that I'm not going to get COVID? How do you respond to folks who are saying, I'll take my chances right now because I really see COVID as a greater threat than some long-term threat?
That's a very good question, Tom. I have the same question for myself, actually. So in terms of the COVID-19, so first, it's a virus. Okay, the general antimicrobial probably won't work, won't kill the virus. And as I mentioned, the regular soap and water, it's still the first choice, just as what the CDC is recommending. So we should wash our hands as much as often as possible. And of course, if we have access to those antimicrobials, they kind of help us to clean our hands and to wash away of those virus or the bacteria, we can still use them. It's just still the soap and water is the first, it's still the first choice. So my point is that antimicrobial ingredients within the hand soap probably wouldn't add much more benefits. But if that kind of could make you feel better or you have access to those, I wouldn't say no, you cannot use them. But the first thing is still the soap and the water and wash your hands for at least like 20 seconds. So that's what I would recommend.
Hongbo, is every type of regular non-antibacterial soap the same? Essentially is soap, and we shouldn't be concerned with what brand we buy?
My answer would be yes. So if you're thinking about how the general soap works, the mechanism they help clean our hands is basically the main ingredients is a surfactant. So they help reduce the surface tension of the water so that they could be easier to break to very small droplet, to small particles. And then the dirt and the pathogens, the bacteria, the virus, they would be easier to be washed off. And also if there's like oil or grease involved like on your hands, on the surface of your body, and then the ingredients from the soap, they're pretty much the same. They help to dissolve those particles, those oil, and then they both dissolve in the water and in the oil, so they could carry over all those particles, including bacteria, virus, and then when you flush them, and then they will wash that away. So that's how the soap works. So to me, I would not worry too much about between different brands. As long as they were regular soap, they have those active ingredients, they should work the same.
That's probably a relief to all of folks out there who have been looking for antibacterials, can't find them, and are thinking, oh my gosh, I'm not taking care of my family properly. What you're saying is just get a good, regular, standard bar of soap and use it long enough to wash everything off.
Yes. Yep, that would be my suggestion. And so if like soap and water, they are not always available, like when you are outside, using the hand sanitizer, it could right. do the same work.
And I was going to ask that question about the hand sanitizer. That's different from an antibacterial, correct? We're not talking about the same risks that the FDA identified several years ago as being a potential problem.
You are right, Tom. They work totally different mechanism.
And you don't see any risk or any danger in terms of using those hand sanitizers, do you?
Let's first take a look of what, when we talk about a hand sanitizer, we know there are many different types of hand sanitizer on the market. So now the most commonly used, they are alcohol-based. So that one has proven to be very effective, and including the current CDC recommends if the soap and water are not available, we should go for the hand sanitizer. And this, and we should use the alcohol content above 60%. So any alcohol-based hand sanitizer with alcohol content greater than 60% should do the job. So as we talked before, the soap and water, they don't really kill the bacteria, they don't kill the virus, but rather they help to wash away them. But for the alcohol-based hand sanitizer, they actually kill the virus, they kill the bacteria. How does it do the job? The alcohol, the molecule, they could dissolve the membrane of the bacterial wall. So basically, they totally mess it up. They dissolve the lipid membrane of the cell. And for virus, the alcohol, they denaturate the protein. So we know the virus is basically a piece of DNA or RNA plus some proteins. So the alcohol does an excellent job to denaturate the protein. Basically, they change the structure of the protein so it doesn't work anymore. That's how the hand sanitizer work to help to kill the virus or kill the bacteria.
Wow.
So
excellent.
That's how, yeah.
Yeah, that's excellent advice. If you're going to make an extra investment, don't go to the antibacterials, go to the alcohol-based hand sanitizers. Great, great suggestion. You're listening to UWM Today right here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujak, and joining us on today's program is Hongbo Ma. She's an associate professor of environmental health sciences at UWM's Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health. We've been talking about whether or not these antibiotic hand soaps that we've been hearing so much about during the COVID-19 crisis are really essential, or if you can get away just using regular hand soap. And Hongbo, I think your advice right now is just scrub up those hands, get the soap everywhere, and it doesn't matter if the antibacterials are in the ingredients or not. Just getting the soap on with some good water and washing it all down the drain is going to be a good bet to help keep you free of the virus, at least getting it off the hands for a period of time. Hongbo, I want to ask you how you first got into studying antibacterials. What attracted you to the study of environmental health sciences as part of your career?
Thank you, Tom. So I have a background both in environmental science and in chemistry, and then in public health. So I have always been concerned about how the human and environment, we kind of interact with each other. And then once I started to get into the public health, and I saw that the great interaction between the human activity and what we put into the environment, they could eventually come back to us. So I've been trained as an environmental toxicologist. So I became very interested in to seeing how those chemicals we introduce into the environment, they eventually, what kind of impact they come back to us, to our ecosystem, to the water we drink, to the air we breathe, and to the food we eat, and eventually impact our human health. So I happen to kind of learn there are some very good animal models could help to do this job. So I have been really fascinated to see how those small little model organisms could help us to kind of to find out what are the potential harmful effects of those chemicals could do through understanding what the chemicals do to those animals, give us insight what they may eventually do to human, because those models, they really share kind of many similarity with human biology. There are like many disease pathway or biological pathway. They were very well conserved between those like fish, the worms, and between those organisms and humans. And they were much less expensive to study on those animals than study in like many models, like a rat or a mouse. And you don't have to kill a lot of those animals to study their toxicity. So that's how I actually get into this. And because I have those tools to study different chemicals, and then the personal care products and antimicrobials, they just came into my attention. They were emerging contaminants, we call them, because we don't realize those are a threat to our public health. One part because we do not use them so much, so often before. And the other reason is we do not have so much scientific knowledge. But now we realize because we, as the development of analytical technology, we can now detect those chemicals in very tiny concentration from food, from our human blood or human urine, or from the water we drink. And then we start to ask the question, what they might do to our human body? So that it really gave me that opportunity, my tools, I could be able to ask if those other emerging chemicals that were coming into contact with human body in our water, what they might do to our health eventually. So I studied kind of to focus on some of those antimicrobial ingredients, because those are among very commonly detected in the water, including in our drinking water. So that's how I started to look at those antimicrobials.
Hongma, as you take a look at the types of people who are most susceptible to the chemical agents that you've been researching here, like the antibacterials, are children more susceptible? Are the elderly? Who's most at risk if they are exposed to these agents?
That's a wonderful question, Tom. So definitely, there is different subpopulation. They have different susceptibility. And as you mentioned, you are very right. The children, because they were at a very critical development window. So the children, the infants, the pregnant women, they're always the most vulnerable population that are susceptible to those kind of chemicals. Thinking about the children, they were just at a very critical stage of their development. They were reproductive system is developing. If there are some endocrine disrupting chemicals hit them during this part, during this time window, it's going to have a lifelong effect, lifelong-term effect to their life, in the rest of their life. That's why when we do this kind of study, we want to kind of focus on specifically on those vulnerable population to see how they could be affected so that any environmental or public health regulation or intervention could be specifically targeting to protect those populations. Yes, that's very right. There are more susceptible.
When you think about people who use the antibacterials, for example, we wash our hands, it goes down the drain and somewhere headed off to the sewage treatment plant and ultimately back out into the lake. Do those agents get cleaned up in the wastewater treatment process, or are they back out into our future drinking water?
That's a great question. Yes, some of them, they get picked up. They get blocked or they get removed during the wastewater treatment plant. But thinking about 30 or 20 years ago, we do not have the technology to detect those compounds. We have no knowledge about what they were potentially doing, and we are not monitoring those chemicals in our effluent after we treat the water, before we discharge them into the lakes and the rivers. So basically, generally speaking, our current water treatment plant infrastructure, they were not designed to remove all those we consider emerging contaminants. So some of them, they get removed, but some of those compounds, they don't. It really depends on the structure, the nature of the chemicals. And also on the other discipline, like they have their environmental remediation, they have water treatment. And those scientists or researchers, they were working tirelessly to develop new technology to remove more of those contaminants. So we are making progress to, as we detect more of those compounds, we have more knowledge about their properties. And then we could develop the new technology and put them into use to remove more of them. So it is an ongoing process. Some of them get efficiently removed. Some of them, they just escaped and they get into our drinking water.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you where you see your research going. Are you going to continue to focus on these emerging contaminants like the harmful antibacterials?
Yes. Emerging contaminants, they were like antimicrobials. They were just a very small part of it. And we are facing, in the ever-changing world, we are facing so many different new chemicals and new challenges. And another, so I'm continue studying those antimicrobials and their replacement compounds. And another part of it's also emerging contaminants, they are algae blooms. They were algal toxins from the algae blooms. So it is also a very big public health threat here currently within the States and around the world. So, and also I've been working on engineered nanomaterials. So those are all considered emerging contaminants. They were just different from traditionally we think like heavy metals, the pesticides, or those organic solvents. We have been studying this for many years, but the emerging contaminants, they will keep emerge as we make new products, we have new scientific discovery. So I'm very fortunate to have had those animal models as the tools kind of help me, give me the capability to study those emerging contaminants.
Well, Hongbo, it's been a fascinating conversation. We wish you the very best with your research going forward. And thanks for the tips that we can save some money by not stocking up on the antibacterial soaps. Just use regular good bar soap or non-antibacterials and a healthy dose of the hand sanitizer with some alcohol. That's my takeaway from today.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Hongbo Ma, Associate Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at the Zilber School of Public Health, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. See you next week. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.